This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Dr. Joseph Sullivan has spoken at our conference before, although it's been too long, so welcome back. Dr. Sullivan is the director of the UCSF Pediatric Epilepsy Center and associate professor of neurology and of pediatrics. Good morning.
Thank you for having me. I was thrilled to be able to come back because there actually have been a lot of, I think it was 4 years ago, there's actually been a lot of developments in the epilepsy, pediatric epilepsy space, and a lot of that has focused on genetics, and you'd have to probably be living in a hole to have not heard about medical marijuana and its implications. So I have a few slides about some of the data at the end of this talk. So when I was first asked to come back, I was asked to speak about atypical seizures. And, you know, I think that's a kind of a broad term. I think a lot of caregivers, medical providers, when they think about seizures, maybe the first type of seizure that jumps to their mind is a grand mal seizure or a generalized tonic-clonic seizure. And I often, when we're teaching our residents, try to tell them that that is actually only one of many different seizure types. And it shouldn't be an alliteration word. You know, when we get the call from the ER, well, what type of seizure was it? Generalized tonic-clonic seizure. And so I think that with detailed video EEG monitoring and being able to take care of a whole host of different patients really allows us to phenotype, so describe the different types of seizures that we can see across different patient populations, and certainly in children and young adults with developmental disabilities, we do know that these different seizure types can occur. So with that, so here is the overview. So I just want to do a very cursory overview of the incidence of epilepsy in children. I then want to just talk about, I could, you know, do a one-hour talk on each of these single seizure types, but sort of hit on a couple of the common syndromes that we see in children and young adults with developmental disability. I want to talk a little bit about the impact of genetics in the era of whole exome sequencing. And I certainly was one of those that said, oh, yeah, genetic testing is interesting, you know, but right now it doesn't actually translate into any changes in our management. But that is changing and is likely going to be continue to change in the next 5 to 10 years. And then I'll talk about some of the emerging treatment options. So these are my disclosures. I am involved with a couple of pharmaceutical companies that are actually investigating some of these novel compounds for some of the rare genetic epilepsies. So just some simple definitions. So what is a seizure? There are actually 3-hour-long symposia at the American Epilepsy Society meeting about what is a seizure. So this is still debated. But for our purposes, I think we can come to an agreement that it's a transient occurrence of signs and or symptoms due to an abnormal, excessive, or synchronous neuronal activity in the brain. And this is what we spend all of our time doing, looking at EEGs and videos to see what's the first thing that happened. Did the right arm move? Did the left arm move? Did the head turn to the side? Because that allows us to look back at our neuroanatomy and have some type of hypothesis as where that seizure is actually starting. As opposed to epilepsy, again, this is debated and the definitions are changing, is still simply defined as 2 or more unprovoked seizures greater than 24 hours apart. And people debate this because what happens when someone has a seizure and then 5 years later has their second seizure? Does that patient have epilepsy? Chief Justice John Roberts, he has epilepsy because that's actually happened to him. So I would say yes. Most of the patients that I treat, it doesn't become that nuanced because the kids are often having frequent seizures. And then this is an expansion of the definition. So having one unprovoked seizure and the probability of having a second seizure being equivalent to if you already had a second seizure, which is generally around the 60%. So there's a trend towards actually giving someone a diagnosis of epilepsy at that point. Now, we can debate whether or not we should actually intervene and start treating in that scenario of someone who has a single seizure, has a high increased risk of a second seizure. Do we actually treat? My personal practice is that I don't, because we still don't know when that second seizure may be, right? So the example that I just brought up, it may be 5 years, And in that scenario, you've exposed someone to a medication for 5 years unnecessarily. If it happens within the next few months, then I think it's actually pretty clear that that tempo of having a seizure every few months warrants intervention. And then diagnosis of an epilepsy syndrome. So what is an epilepsy syndrome? This is the other academic topic that we get really excited about. If we can take someone that walks into our clinic with a diagnosis of spells and then have them leave with a diagnosis of an epilepsy syndrome so that they actually have a more specific label that they can put on their diagnosis. And not only does that actually help inform treatment and prognosis, but it, as I'll show you in a couple of slides, I think it really helps families reach out to other disease-specific organizations so that they know that the they can have support from other people who are dealing with similar types of seizures and comorbidities. And so what is an epilepsy syndrome? It's a complex of signs and symptoms that define a unique epilepsy condition with different etiologies. And the three pillars that go into determining the epilepsy syndrome are the age of onset, so very different if someone presents at 6 months of age as opposed to 6 years of age, the seizure type, and then the EEG pattern. And again, this is what we do in comprehensive epilepsy centers is rather than just giving someone a diagnosis of seizure disorder, which I hate that term, seizure disorder tells us nothing. People who have don't have heart rhythm disorders, right? They have specific cardiac arrhythmias. So we like to be able to be very accurate in our seizure diagnosis. And lastly, this term semiology. I'm going to show you a few seizure videos here. So the semiology are all of the nuances that happen at, prior, at the onset, during, and after the seizure that allow us to put a label other than generalized tonic-clonic. So how about epilepsy in children with intellectual disability? This is an old paper, but epilepsy is common. Even in the general population, it's estimated to be about 1% of the population, but it's has a five-fold increase in prevalence in those with intellectual disability. And when you look at the severity of intellectual disability, you can see there's a range here, but if one has mild through the spectrum of severe, the incidence of epilepsy does increase as the severity of the intellectual disability also increases. So why? Why is that? Well, I don't think we actually know. I think the genetics here are hopefully going to shed a little bit more light on that. But when I explain this to parents, I basically say epilepsy simply is a disorder of brain function. Development and cognition in a child and a developing brain rely on normal brain function. And because development is not a static process, you can imagine that someone who is prone to having seizures as a result of a functional disorder of their brain may also be prone to having abnormal development over time. So this is one of the joys and frustrations of my job. So the brain, yes, adults, your brain is still changing, but hopefully we would all agree when we have a newborn that then becomes an infant and then a sassy teenager, a lot of stuff happens there in the brain, right? And so it is a moving target, and we can have instances where there is either a genetic abnormality, a structural brain abnormality that is present in the newborn period but may actually not be symptomatic until later on. And so we have to be prepared to reevaluate children as they mature because their seizure types may change, and that may actually dictate a change in their treatment. So just a little vignette here. So you have a child who comes in with new-onset infantile spasms, and I'm going to show you a video of this. We do a brain MRI, which is pretty much standard of care now, and it shows a developmental brain malformation. That patient is treated and does well. Spasms respond, and this child is seizure-free for a few years. But then later, the child develops a new type of seizure, tonic and atonic seizures, which, again, I'm going to show you. And now this is a diagnosis of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. Then we treat Lennox-Gastaut syndrome with very different types of medications. It's unusual to be able to get someone with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome truly seizure-free. But then as that child becomes an adult and ends up in my adult epilepsy colleague's clinic, then they actually may just look like they have treatment-resistant complex partial seizures. And so I think my adult epilepsy colleagues have a really difficult job because these patients show up, and unless you go back or they've come from their pediatric colleagues and you have the nice longitudinal documentation of all the different seizure types, you may not appropriately diagnose someone in adulthood unless you go back and understand how their seizures presented and how it evolved over time. Okay, so onto a few videos here. So infantile spasms. Here's a cute little baby. And let's just play this video for those of you who haven't seen. So what you'll see, you have an awake, alert, interactive, non-dysmorphic appearing baby who is starting to have what we would say are bilateral flexor extensor. You see the hips are coming up, the legs are coming up, the arms are extending and then briefly adducting to the midline. And it's coming in a cluster, right? It's coming pretty regular. Very often there's a cry in between there. But this couldn't be, and this is actually taken from the Child Neurology Foundation website about it, it's an instructional video. It couldn't be any more classic, and you see the little facial grimace as well. So this is something that we drive home to our pediatric residents, that if you have a baby who's having startles or having these exaggerated Moro response, you know, the Moro reflex, that if it's coming in clusters like this, that's something that arguably is one of the infantile epilepsy medical emergencies, in the sense that you want these kids evaluated likely within a week. So that's a very typical video for infantile spasms. And I'm just going to go through this sort of table here for a couple of the syndromes so that we understand why making that specific seizure diagnosis and semiology diagnosis is important. So you can see the age of onset is in infancy, hence the name infantile spasms. The seizure semiology, that was pretty classic of the flexor extensor spasm. So we had the mix. You don't always have to have the flexor part. You don't always have to have the extensor part. You can have just each of those. But once you see it, it's really hard to misdiagnose. I think the thing that happens with families that they get really nervous about is they worry about the duration of the seizure. So the cluster may last 15, 20 minutes. But you saw each one of those individual spasms literally lasted for about 1 second. And so if you have 20 to 30 spasms in a 20-minute cluster, that total time spent seizing was actually only 20 to 30 seconds. The EEG is very helpful. It can show us this classical hypsarrhythmia pattern, and it really can be made in a one-hour outpatient EEG. It's very important to capture sleep. This is another teaching point. We tell our medical residents that if you have a baby that did that in your office and the EEG is normal, you have to make sure that you've actually captured sleep, and you can't just write them off. If you did capture sleep, you have to repeat that EEG in a few weeks, because it could be a chance that you're actually just making this diagnosis very, very early and the hypsarrhythmia hasn't had a chance to develop. So the etiology is really, really broad. So malformations of cortical development or neonatal encephalopathy, so some perinatal birth difficulties, represent the majority. But the very, very close second in the era of genetic testing are various genetic abnormalities. And you can see here tuberous sclerosis, neurofibromatosis, and Down syndrome are some of the common genetic diagnoses. And I'm going to show you a slide later with a whole host of genes that have now been associated with infantile spasms. So treatment is very different. These aren't the kids that we give phenobarbital. These aren't the kids that we give Keppra. These are very syndrome-specific treatments, generally high-dose steroids, which is not a great medication in terms of tolerability, or a medication called vigabatrin, which does have some potential for retinal toxicity. But when we look at the developmental outcomes of untreated infantile spasms, we know that being aggressive early and trying to cycle through the treatments that we know can be effective is critical to having any chance of a normal developmental outcome. So moving on to one other syndrome here. So I'm going to have a series of three videos here. So here's a young woman with Down syndrome who came in to better understand what types of seizures she's having. You can see she's playing with her little Etch-a-Sketch thingy. Oh, here we go. So she has abrupt jerk there, extension of the arms, and then she looks like it's done, and then it happens again, and she's holding it, and then she just readjusts herself, and then she's going to totally pick up her little toy here again and start playing with it. So you can see that there's some overlap between a spasm, right, that actually had a little bit of a stuttering and clustering, but that was it. So that was just two. But you can see that the duration that the arms were held was longer. It was not this sort of crescendo decrescendo of a spasm, and so rather this is a tonic seizure. Sometimes it's not so easy. So here you're going to see a combination of two things. The helmet should be a giveaway that this child is at risk for falling. Mom's holding onto his hand here. That actually went a little bit slower than it was supposed to, but you can see, imagine what would have happened if he would not have been standing at the bedside and Mom would not have had her hand there. He would have dropped to the ground. And there is a common theme now, especially in epilepsy drug studies, of how you count these seizures. What do you call that? You notice the arms went out, the head went down, and so we can have, you know, epilepsy banter here. Was that a tonic, atonic? Was it tonic with a head drop? All these different things are interesting and can be teased out with detailed video EEG monitoring. But the big picture, it's a drop attack. This kid would have fallen. And so we treat drop attacks very seriously because of the secondary injuries that these patients can sustain. And then on that same theme, here's another child who's playing with his truck. And you're going to see he's actually in a sitting position, right? So if he was just to have, you know, atonia, he may fall to the side, which he can do, but the arms come out, and then there's still that little bit of extension, and he stays extended. Dad's over there in the corner. He's like, I think you're okay. And he stays down, and then he sits back up. So those are all sort of themes of tonic and atonic seizures that lead to drop attacks. And we just know that drop attacks carry they're brief, but because of the associated morbidity that they cause with regard to secondary injury, they can be very debilitating for patients and their caregivers. So what is Lennox-Gastaut syndrome? So I have a European-Italian colleague, and you know, the Europeans are very good semiologists, and so they really scrutinize even better than the Americans do. And there's a lot of debate as to us Americans over-diagnosing Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. And that may be true, because the core syndrome as described by Lennox and Gastaut probably is rare. But for the purposes of our talk here, I just want to sort of lump them into these types of seizures that we can see, namely the tonic axial seizures, which you saw the picture of, and then the atonic seizures. And the other key component that really represents that core phenotype are these atypical absence seizures, which these are the ones that are very, very difficult to tell, right? Even when you have neurotypical kids, they're going to stare. Adults stare. I can see some of you guys staring right now. Are you actually having an atypical absence seizure? So, you know, it's very difficult to tell. And so in some children and young adults with intellectual disability, you know, parents, they know these kids well, just like I said in the previous talk. They are their best provider. And so they can tell that something happens and that there's an on and off. But sometimes the on of the staring, or the sort of little bit of being a little bit more disconnected, is a little bit more gray, and the off is a little bit more gray. And I would argue that it's almost impossible to be 100% sure unless you actually have a EEG on at the time. But that is the seizure type that tends to really bring all those three, tonic, atonic, and the atypical absence, together to represent the true core phenotype of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. The EEG findings is very, very helpful. We can actually see EEG abnormalities even in between seizures. So with an appropriate history of those types of seizures that you would describe to me, together with a one-hour EEG, we can very often make the clinical diagnosis of Lennox-Gastaut. And you'll see some overlap here in terms of the etiologies of infantile spasms in Lennox-Gastaut. So brain malformation, so malformations of cortical development are very common. You can see that there can be this evolution from infantile spasms to Lennox-Gastaut. This is also associated with Down syndrome, associated with Angelman syndrome. From the few autopsy specimens that we do have, there can be the patients that actually have normal brain MRIs are thought to maybe have microscopic neurodevelopmental abnormalities or sort of cortical dysplasia, where the normal six-layer cortex is not organized in the way that it should. But still, there's a whole host of patients that to this day are Lennox-Gastaut of unknown cause. And that's really where we hope that with whole exome sequencing, we're going to arrive at some discoveries. Treatment. So we base it on seizure type, but we also base it on experience in the literature over the last four decades since valproate has been available. We know that valproate and valproate and lamotrigine together can be actually synergistic. Benzodiazepines, I know we don't like benzodiazepines, but they can be very helpful for the different seizure types that we see in the syndrome. And then the medication felbamate. It's not a medicine that we usually reach for as the first or second line medication in any of the epilepsies, but it can be particularly effective for the tonic and atonic seizures that are associated with the syndrome. And so because of the morbidity that they cause, I tend to start having that talk with families sooner rather than later. The incidence of intellectual disability, sorry, I have this old term in there, my apologies, is high, and we know that the chronic treatment-resistant seizures can evolve over time. So again, you have to be able to react accordingly to those different seizure types. So here's my really simplified breakdown of what I do in the clinic every day. So you have someone who comes in with seizures and a developmental disability. We still, all this fancy EEG, whole exome sequence, we still want to look at the patient, talk to the family, and examine them, okay? And so I am not a geneticist. I am not a dysmorphologist. If I see something that looks a little different, I will rely on my genetic colleagues to hopefully refine that a bit. But if someone does have specific features of a genetic syndrome, we want to proceed to genetic targeted gene testing. And then if we have a specific diagnosis, such as Down syndrome, such as Angelman syndrome, we can then still, it's clinically based, right? We're still going to treat based on the predominant seizure type. But this is where we can use the literature, and we can use family reporting, and now the whole explosion of social media. Often families are coming into me and say, well, I read on the Angelman syndrome board that is a bad medicine for Angelman syndrome. And we're learning a lot as healthcare providers from families. If you have someone who just has a nonspecific or pretty much a normal neurologic and physical exam, then we have to sort of broaden, I think, our net a bit. We still rely very, very heavily on neuroimaging, brain MRI. Even in the age of genetic panels and exome sequencing, we can't forget about a good old chromosomal microarray, because we can still pick up different copy number variants on a microarray that can be very, very important in 10 to 15% of patients with seizures and developmental disability. And then really with the imaging and some type of genetic testing, we can go into two broad branching points where if the imaging is abnormal, does that actually fit into a known malformation syndrome? But again, we're still treating based on the seizure type. See, I'm preaching some job security here, because it's still based on us having a good understanding what types of seizures are actually present. But that if we do have a specific genetic diagnosis, then we start to not only look at the literature, but in these specific instances that I have up here, SCN1A, tuberous sclerosis, and PCDH19, we know that there are specific treatment strategies to avoid and some that to lean more towards that can be particularly effective for those groups of patients. And our hope is that someday everyone who has a diagnosis of epilepsy will actually have a specific gene disorder that we can actually be a little bit more specific rather than just basing it on the seizure type. So this is just a paper that was published about 7 years ago, and a lot has happened in 7 years, but they're basically acknowledging that genetic testing is important and going to become increasingly important. And this is a beautiful graph that shows the real availability of next-generation sequencing. So whole exome really happened. It happened where you can see the blue bubble there at 2007. It was about $100,000 to get it back in 2007. Today, it's about some places you can get for $5,000 for a trio, so parents and a child. And you can see that in the pre-next-generation sequencing era, we were doing okay. We had some pretty important epilepsy genes, all of which are associated with various degrees of intellectual disability. But since the next-generation sequencing era, you can see that there's been this sort of exponential rise in the number of gene discoveries. And not only has there been an exponential rise in the gene discoveries, but the amount of research that's going on in each of these specific genes is also increasing dramatically. So why does this matter? I tell this story it's a story of Tracy Dixon Salazar, who is a friend and colleague of mine, and who has a daughter who had Lennox-Gastaut of unknown cause. And she actually went to get her PhD in developmental neuroscience, and this was right at the time when whole exome sequencing was just starting to become a research tool. She had a very typical presentation, as I had in that graph, of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, with hundreds of seizures per month, multiple medication trials, weekly use of rescue medications. And then she sequenced her own daughter's exome, and they found an abnormality in a calcium channel gene. And generally, we don't reach toward, you know, the cardiac calcium channel blockers in the epilepsy space, but they put her on a calcium channel blocker, and lo and behold, she had a 95% reduction in seizures. She had no need for rescue medications. They were able to reduce her other medications, and she had improved alertness and function. And Tracy tells her 20-minute story at different meetings to really try and drive home the utility of genetic testing. And she shows pictures of her daughter pre and post seizures, and it's really remarkable. So we do have an amazing opportunity, I think, ahead of us. So just to cover some other things, just with single slides, because I know that it's been addressed here at this conference, infantile spasms, as I showed you, are a common seizure type in children with Down syndrome. Interestingly, and this is by no means a one-size-fits-all, but children with Down syndrome who present with infantile spasms tend to respond more favorably than non-Down syndrome patients, and we actually don't understand that. Maybe there's something about the X chromosome we don't really really understand. They can still evolve into Lennox-Gastaut. They may have other seizure types, as you saw, that young woman who had the tonic seizures. And the hard part here is that the EEG can be abnormal even with no history of seizure. So again, my job security, you have to get a good history of a seizure. Don't inappropriately diagnose someone with epilepsy just because they have an abnormal EEG. You have to have the history together with the EEG to make that diagnosis. And then here's just one video I want to show you of in terms of how detailed phenotyping actually can lead to a genetic diagnosis. So I want you to watch this little girl. Whoops. Watch this little girl. Let me go back one more. They're going to do it from me up in the box. There you go. Thank you. So describe what you see. She's sleeping. There's a little bit of hypermotoric. Maybe she's just up and she's cranky, right? She's developmentally very abnormal. She has some kicking movements of the legs. It's playing a little bit slower than, and now... Now we see some stiffening, so there's extension of the arms and legs. So we have hypermotor slash agitation. Now we have stiffening, so we have tonic. And now I won't let this play the whole time, but she's going to relax here and then almost go into a little spasm. She's no longer an infant, so these are not infantile spasms. They're not called epileptic spasms. But if we actually look at the hypermotor tonic spasm, so this is a sequence. And this was actually published in the Journal of Neurology by the Australian group, because they noticed that this was a specific seizure type that actually happened in mostly girls. CDKL5 encephalopathy is a genetic diagnosis that happens mainly with girls. But we've actually, when we evaluate patients, infant girls who have spasms, and you get this sort of history, now you know the questions to ask. You can go back and, did she ever wake up and look like she's scared? And then that goes into the spasm, and that can almost be your cheapest genetic testing right there. You can almost predict, nothing is 100% obviously, but you can almost predict that this could be the diagnosis. And why is this important? Right now, we don't necessarily have any specific treatments that are tailored to CDKL5 encephalopathy. But again, there's great, usually parent form support groups that really go a long way in terms of providing that social support and funding the necessary research that we need. This is just a quick slide to also show that there's been a huge expansion in the amount of anti-epileptic drugs that have been available since 2000. Unfortunately, a lot of them aren't significantly more effective than the ones that were back in the good old phenobarbital ages, but thankfully they are better tolerated. So we have equal efficacy, but patients are actually truly living with their epilepsy and not falling asleep. So the emerging treatment. So this is kind of the wrapping up here. So despite all of those new drugs, and again, despite all of those new drugs, the number of treatment-resistant patients, which we define as still having seizures despite medication, has not changed, which is embarrassing, I think. We still use drugs. That's really where there's devices and there's all these nice, fancy, cutting-edge things that are going out, but drugs are still the main treatment modality. But our hope is, again, I keep hitting the genetic drum, is that if we can get to a better diagnosis, a more accurate genetic diagnosis, will that actually lead to better treatments? And so cannabidiol. So it's actually been, there's been many, many reports, even of cannabis sativa being used for various medical disorders. Cannabidiol is just one of the many compounds in the cannabis plant. And the two that are getting the most attention are really CBD, cannabidiol, and THC, so tetrahydrocannabinoid, which is what gives the psychoactive component from cannabis. And really this all happened 5 or 6 years ago when there many parents were frustrated with the lack of effective treatments for their children with various epilepsy diagnoses, but most specifically with Dravet syndrome. And this one little girl named Charlotte Figge, her parents, when they were living in Colorado, and Colorado is one of the first states to have medical marijuana available, tried her on a oil that had a high concentration of cannabidiol and a low concentration of THC, and lo and behold, she actually had a dramatic reduction and had prolonged periods of seizure freedom. So Sanjay Gupta got involved, a lot of stuff happened, and there was a company that actually for decades had already been had a pure form of cannabidiol that was plant extracted available. And so they contacted a bunch of centers, and we were a center that were involved with this, where we basically did an expanded access IND, so under compassionate use protocol, and we treated 214 patients with treatment-resistant epilepsy. This was not placebo-controlled, so they were just given cannabidiol. They had a 4-week baseline seizure count followed by 12 weeks of treatment, and everything was kept by seizure diary. And the median reduction in seizures was about 35%. So it works. There were some patients that were seizure-free. A subsequent placebo-controlled trial that was done in Dravet syndrome has been completed, and the median reduction in seizures was 39%. Compared to placebo of 13%. So similar, but again, we have to factor in that placebo number. They just haven't, that data is not published yet. It's just a press release data from the company. So this does work, but it's by no means, you know, it's another tool in our toolbox is what I'll explain to families, and it is by no means the cure-all for many patients. So wrapping up, so where are we today in 2017? And to bring this to full closure in terms of the power of genetics, I have some extremely bright people that work at UCSF that are taking these known genetic epilepsies. Scott Barabin at UCSF has about 80 different genetic mutations that have been discovered in forms of different pediatric epilepsy. And using this new gene editing technology called CRISPR, he's able to insert the specific genetic mutation into a zebrafish. And why zebrafish? Turns out zebrafish can actually, you can turn around large populations of zebrafish as compared to mice, which are a lot of, or even fruit flies. And then you can literally take the zebrafish. Many of them do have seizures. I won't go into how they see this fish seizing, but it's very interesting. It's very, very interesting. There's cameras, and but then they literally will take different medications and put them in the water, and then the fish are ingesting the medication, and they can do toxicity studies, they can do different concentrations of the medication, and they see which of these compounds actually reduce seizures. And so, and he does this in a blinded way, and this really, I think, is a whole other era for drug repurposing, right? So you have drugs that are already out there and FDA approved, that we already have the toxicity data, but we just never thought to try them in patients with epilepsy. And so in a blinded fashion, he takes these compounds, he puts them in the water, he sees which ones actually cause a reduction in seizure, and then you unveil the bottle and see what drug it is, and then start to look into how that drug works and better understand the mechanism of action. So I really think that this is going to be a very, very important technology to give us some better treatments. So last slide, so take home points. Hopefully you will not just say generalized tonic-clonic seizure. So epilepsy has many different faces, and all seizures can look very, very different. I've put my foot in my mouth so many times to say, oh, that can't be a seizure. If it's stereotyped and it's recurrent, don't blow it off and have it evaluated further. We know that patients with developmental disabilities are particularly challenging due to the many different underlying etiologies. And again, this accurate classification of seizures is critical so that we can ideally arrive at some gene discoveries with some more targeted based treatments. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.